All right, may I ask for a roll call, please?
Trustee Robert Boy. Trustee Robert Marshall.
Here.
Trustee Mark Strauss.
Here.
Trustee Tim Struthers.
Here.
Committee Chair John Butler.
Here. Mr. Blakemore, can you verify that appropriate notice of this meeting has been posted and that we have a quorum for business?
Mr. Chair, members of the Committee on Governance, we have a quorum and the appropriate notice pursuant to the Opening of the Meetings Act has been made.
Okay. May I ask for a motion to approve the meeting agenda?
So moved.
Been a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? The agenda is approved. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 4th, 2016?
So moved.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. This is a chance for me to give some remarks. I actually am going to give some remarks. The reason I had you receive this copy, I'm going to speak very specifically and somewhat more casually to the committee, even though we have our usual standing room only audience this morning or this afternoon. The reason that I passed this item out is because of page 2. I want us to just go through as a group where we are at this point. And without too much fanfare, I want us to notice that on page 2 of this document that was just passed out that has the university's logo on it, on page 2 begins the list of items that this committee has had committed to managing. And we can just move right through. A1, we can put a check over that, presidential succession policy. Number A2, that's naming rights. We're going to talk about that today. A3, we can put a check on that. That's updating the records retention policy. Number 4 is the university insurance and employment benefits policy. There's been some discussion of that item in various settings, so we're not ignoring it, but we have not yet dealt with it as a committee. Number 5, update the indemnification policy. That's been done. We have developed the professional development and travel expense policy. The presidential house matter has been dealt with. We clarified some issues related to the number of votes necessary to continue balloting when no candidate obtains the minimum required votes. That we can put a check on that. We had some things we were talking about doing with officer elections and numbers B9. We haven't really dealt with that. We can circle that as something that might come up at some point soon. The conflict of interest policy we've dealt with. The administrative leave policy we've dealt with. The reform of the standing committees, you're going to hear a little bit about that today, although we're not going to deal with it in any substantive fashion. Orientation and continuing professional development. We dealt with it at some level when we talked about the disclosure of interest policy, but we may still want to deal with it, so that's something we should circle. The appeal rights for appeals to the board, that's something we should circle. Number 15 assumed that we were going to engage in a process of the assessment of the board's performance. And its structure. We should circle that because I have some ideas on that that I'll share with you at subsequent meetings. And then when we get into number 16, you can see back when we first created this ad hoc committee, we wanted to talk about constitutional review and reform. This is a subject that will be discussed today with the assistance of Dr. Long. And so we'll continue this as well. That's something we can circle. The reason I went through this, I wanted to visually show all of you that we've been a very productive ad hoc committee. We've achieved a lot. We've got a lot through the full board. I think we should be very proud of the work that we've done. I think we've been a very productive ad hoc committee. So I want to thank all of you. I want you to to see visually what we have been able to achieve together. And that's really the only comments I want to make. I do want to welcome Greg Long and Holly Nicholson and ask if you have any interest in saying anything at this point.
I'll wait till later.
I don't, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate it. Moving right to the university recommendations, the first item on the agenda. Do we have any interest in making public comment, Mr. Blake?
We do not have any requests, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mark, for reminding me of that. So we'll move on then to 7A, which is the naming rights policy. Now, you'll know the history behind this is we've had this on our agenda a couple times before, but this has been something that has been receiving a lot of attention within the university-level policymaking apparatus, particularly with respect to the foundation. We are now in receipt of a draft proposal, which would involve the amendment of the board regulations, as well as the development of a standards document. I'm going to turn the floor over to Dr. Alan Phillips, who will tell us a little bit more about the proposal that we have in front of us.
The last naming policy was a university policy, and I believe was done for President Peters back in 2007. So it's about 9 years old. There have been a number of issues that have arisen with regard to the naming of facilities, the foundation involvement, the board's purview. So as a result, we undertook a review of the existing policy with the intent to try to address all of the outstanding issues that had come to our attention. We took our, one of the things my office did was, the first thing we did was to go out and take a look at other universities' policies. Rather than just start with our policy, we went out, took a look at a number of the other policies from other universities in the state and other locations to see if there were similarities, if there were some benchmarks or things that were standard policies and procedures that we would incorporate into our policy. Also, we took a look to, because the way things are done now in terms of naming facilities is perhaps a little different than it might have been done 10 or more years ago. So we worked with the Vice President for Advancement, Catherine Squires, and we met with a number of people internally, received some input from various trustees. And so we put together a proposed new proposed naming policy. This is a draft. It still needs to go back to the foundation. Certainly the foundation board and members of the foundation have not yet had a chance to weigh in on this. We expect to get some feedback because there's a number of things that are significant changes from how we've done things in the past. The first major change is limited term naming. So in the past, typically, once you named a building, it was in perpetuity. And so now you would name, and this is keeping in line with more standard practices in this area, you would have to provide at least 51% of the funding to have an opportunity to name the facility. Another thing we've added in, plus 5% maintenance costs. So we're building in, and let me back up a little. This policy only applies to facilities. It does not apply to the naming of rooms or conference rooms or auditoriums, or that is actually covered under foundation policy. This policy just addresses the naming of facilities. So to name a facility, you have to provide at least 51%, and we start at basically a $1 million project. we picked that amount because, as you know, you can't even put an intersection in for $500,000. So to get a facility built, we thought the reasonable level of giving would be 51% of $1 million, or roughly $500,000 would be the start. Tied to the size of the gift is the term that you would have naming rights for that facility. Once that term is up, you would have first rights of refusal. We would go back, but no longer would we name things in perpetuity. The other thing is that, like I said, this only applies to facilities. It does not apply to interior spaces or names or plaques that would be affixed to those facilities. It does address the funding levels, and particularly the 51%, the limited naming rights, and the levels of gifts to get certain terms of naming are things that certainly would be of interest to the board. We tried to address in the policy the scope. This would also include multimedia licensing agreement, sponsorship contracts would come back to the board for approval. As we've said, interior spaces are actually addressed by recommendation of the university vice president for university advancement. And pretty much all of these recommendations would be reviewed by the vice president for advancement, the vice president for academic affairs, and the vice president for administration and finance prior to the recommendation coming to the board. We also included in the in this policy original facilities and longstanding honorary designations. So what happens if you have an existing facility and you would like an opportunity to rename that? How would you go about addressing that? We lay out the level of terms we put in here. As I said, the 5% maintenance and a 51% requirement for valuation. We do talk about other naming opportunities, academic and administrative. We also put in this policy probably a bit more shared governance in terms of an advisory committee that would include representatives from the faculty and student bodies for certain types of naming opportunities. So we believe that this is a much better policy. It's much more comprehensive. It's much more current in terms of industry standards. And once again, this is a draft, but we still have to go back to the foundation for their input, but we feel a lot of good work has gone into this. Jerry, you had there were a couple of comments that you also had.
Yeah, I can speak to those. Yeah. If I could just point out to the committee members, what we are considering here is similar to the administrative leave policy that we proposed and adopted at the last full board meeting, in the sense that there is a component of this that we are leaving to the purview of the administration so that there is created a university level policy. That's this. This is a university level policy, which means it's not at this point being presented to us to become a board policy. The board policy is voting on the change to the board the board regulations, which is this document, which makes reference to the policy. That doesn't mean that we can't talk about the policy. Certainly that's why we're here. But your support of these changes, I suspect, will be contingent on what you think of this policy. But the policy itself does indicate that the policy will be reviewed periodically and any substantial changes to it from what we are adopting by way of adopting this will be presented to the board I suspect, as an information item going forward. So I don't know if Mr. Blakemore wants to...
Well, actually, I can talk to the two additional comments that were made regarding the draft policy. We talk specific positions. We will add or equivalent position to give us a little bit more flexibility. The other thing we'll need to add is, under what circumstances would we choose to remove the name from the building, depending on the incident or if someone dishonored the university, how that would be addressed as well if something was named after them. So that's another piece of this that we'll have to address.
You mean you'll flush out more the process you will undertake to determine whether that's occurred?
I think it's both a process issue and the proposal now, and specifically Section C, and particularly C.2. There are four criteria that the university, based on this proposal, would have available to it in order to remove a name. Purely from the perspective of the university, obviously not speaking for the foundation or the vice president for advancement, I think it would be beneficial for the university to have the option of removing a name where there has been disfavor or immoral issues or issues that come up from a donor that at the time of the donation were not in play, but later on become very similar to what has happened now with a number of the corporate marketers where, for example, with a former soccer player, they were removed from being able to provide sponsorship, etc. So our suggestion was that we would look at that language and come back and make some amendments there. There's also the famous case of Bill Cosby on the higher education side, wherein the same types of things have occurred, and we actually find at major institutions people rethinking the naming of facilities and schools because of now some evidence of things that are not consistent with the mission and purpose of a university. So we just wanted to broaden this a bit, to include that, and obviously it's an issue that may be of concern to the foundation and the like, because you don't want to tie their arms, their hands on it. But by the same token, the university, I believe, needs to reserve that as a right. So.
Yes, sir.
Does this apply only to new buildings, or are you talking about existing buildings as well?
This applies to both. In other words, we have existing buildings.
Home Student Center, for example.
Under this, we would have a policy whereby we would review what buildings might be, existing buildings might be available for naming opportunities. Probably the best example is Newhall. That's an existing building. That's an opportunity. We would also look at other buildings and look at the history of how they were named and determine there were opportunities there. On the other hand, there may be circumstances where we would not consider changing the name of the building for various purposes. But we are looking into that because that's an opportunity. If there's no historical connection, if there's no history, there may be some opportunities to rename buildings. And once again, it would be for limited periods of time, depending on the size of the donation. There would be other reasons why we would not change the name, but like I said, Newhall is probably the very best example, I suspect.
Newhall has not been named yet, right?
Correct, but it's already existing.
I'm thinking of over my past 20 years that there have been numerous buildings that have been named individually for many good reasons. Are we going to go back and now examine each one of those?
We're not going to... basically, the rules are in place going forward. In other words, for instance, if someone's named a building and it was under the previous policy, the time rules don't apply. So in other words, we're not going to say, okay, once the policy is approved, the clock starts in 10 years. If you don't give us more money, we're taking your name off. That's not this at all. But we are going to go back and take a look at the history and determine if there are some opportunities. We have no intent of renaming all the buildings, but there may be some that might present an opportunity where there's no reason we could not do that or would not do that, but we're not going to go back and rename.
My only purpose of mentioning it is only for what to handle with sensitivity.
Correct, absolutely. We're the buildings we're talking about are buildings that the names go back so long that nobody can remember why they were named what they were. So more recent naming of facilities would probably not be something that we would consider. We're talking about buildings that no one can remember why they were named or that no family still exist, or but that would be a very deliberate process, and we would do nothing recommendations.
Might I make a point of clarification on this, Trustee Boy? That matter is discussed on the last page of this policy, page 10, and it's essentially dealt with under number 7, the effective date and applicability of the policy. In which case, there's a grandfather clause, right, basically, that says that the policy deals only with future naming. So our recent naming of Faraday 2 after John LaTourette, that would not be covered under this policy.
Correct.
Similar to the issues of the Chesick Center, the Jordan, or the Chesick Practice Arena, the Jordan Center, the Barsima 2 buildings would not be part of this policy. All right, I think we've essentially explained the policy that's before us. Now let's see if the committee has any concerns or questions. Trustee Strauss.
I'd like to focus on the proposed changes to the regulations of the Board of Trustees, and I think I have the following comments. First, I would not want there to be a change in the standards unless it came back to the Board for approval. As I read 1B currently, there would be a triennial review and substantive changes would be reported. I would want those, I don't care whether it's reviewed triennially, biennially, or on what the schedule is, but I wouldn't want there to be changes made until it came back to the Board for approval. Second, in Section 1C, there is a delegated authority with respect to rooms and other facilities within buildings. And those are to conform to university standards. Again, my preference would be that those standards get approved by the board and that when there are changes, they come back for board approval. Otherwise, I don't mind delegating the authority for the naming. It occurs to me that there's the potential to read sections 1C and 2A2 so that they address the same thing but in different ways. So 1C says that the board delegates the authority to develop and recommend naming protocols for internal spaces within facilities to the Division of University Advancement. 2A2 says naming spaces internal to a building or facility shall be approved by the Vice President for University Advancement, the Executive Vice President and Provost, and the Vice President for Administration and Finance. So I don't know who's ultimately responsible for this, and where you've got three people, whether all three have to agree, and I think it would be good to be able to clarify that. All right? My next comment is with regard to Section 2A1. 2A1 provides first that there can be a confidential report made and then to the chairman of the FFOC committee if donor confidentiality is an issue. So my question here is whether it is possible for there to be a confidential report. Legal can weigh in on this, but my assumption is that if there was such a report, that report, and it was in writing, that report would be subject to a FOIA request. So I had raised this issue in prior conversations that I had about this matter with people. I do believe that the board should be consulted in some way early in this process, but if confidentiality is an issue, I don't think stating that it's confidential necessarily makes it so. We at least need to think through that. And then I'm interested in the viewpoint of my colleagues here as to whether the appropriate reporting relationship is to the chairman of FFOC, if that's going to happen, or and if it should only be to one person, because I think it would put the board chair, whoever that person is, in a potentially challenging position of not knowing what's happening if this report only goes to a committee chair.
Why don't we first consult with Mr. Blakemore on the confidentiality question?
To the extent that the negotiations with in terms of naming rights are deliberative, i.e. you don't have a final report, I believe that you can you can comply with FOIA and not have to disclose that. To the extent that it becomes final, then it is a public document, and I'm not certain that, in fact, I'm certain that there is no exemption of the, what is it now, Greg, 37 exemptions or something like that, that would apply. So to the extent that you are engaged in discussions, negotiations, and the numbers are changing or the conditions are changing, those need not be disclosed pursuant to FOIA. But you're absolutely right. There is no confidential document where there's been a final report related to public business.
In terms of the question of procedure and forwarding the confidential report to the chair of the FFOC, I think perhaps it should say, shall make a confidential report to the board chair and chair of the FFOC, or members of the board. It could say and or members of the board, but once we do that, then we might as well just have it go to the board. But I'm assuming there's a desire to have some very, somewhat more limited dialogue with principal people on the board who could give you some feedback before you go to the board with the proposal. So why not make it the chair and the chair of FFOC? I agree with Trustee Strauss. I wanted to agree. I think what we're talking about in terms of the triennially versus whenever there's a change is we're really looking for a ratification of those changes. So when there's been a change to the standards, those will be brought to the board for ratification in some way. Getting rid of this triennial review process.
Sure.
Would that be sufficient?
Well, that would be sufficient to address my issue. You may want there to be a triennial review or some scheduled review so that it doesn't go for another 10 years before anybody takes a look at it. So I don't object to that principle
that was,
in any way.
That was actually the intent, to force there to be a review whatever needs to be updated at that point in time would be updated. So otherwise, you may end up with another 10 years before it actually comes up for review, and that may be only after you've identified problems that you would have preferred to have addressed earlier.
So in further answer to your question, John, I view these as being two separate issues. One is I would want there to be board approval of policy changes as they occur. The second is there probably should be some sort of periodic review requirement, whatever period of time people are comfortable with.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may, a point of clarification. You made reference to ratification on the part of the board. Ratification is very different than prior approval. And I think that what you're saying is it would require prior approval of the board for the standards, opposed to authorizing action be taken that is later possibly ratified. So just with that clarification, we're really not saying operate without prior approval.
I guess I'm struggling from a larger theoretical place as to if we are engaged in prior approval of changes to the policy, and if by this action we're adopting not only the regulations but the policy, to what extent does it still exist as a university level policy? Well, I guess this is just a theoretical question. What is, if the board is regularly responsible for approving not only the commencement of the policy, but also any subsequent changes to the policy, can we still call it a university-level policy? We've not had this discussion before.
Yeah, and this is written in the context that it would be a university policy, and when we revised it, we would report that certainly to the board. I'm also reasonably assured it would be done in much the same way that this is done, with consultation, with discussion, but that in fact we would not necessarily be asking for board approval of the university policy, but we would report to the board much like this, any changes that we've been made, get feedback and input, and then any recommendation based on this policy that would have to come to the board, because that's a policy that's written. Naming policies.
So now I understand the question.
Yes.
And my view of it is, I would not want to have this be something on which the board loses control to changes before they occur.
So I think one of the reasons why I thought this was probably best as a university-level policy was because it involved so much university-level activity, and there were aspects of this policy that I thought might be terms of art and tradecraft related to advancement, that it would be a level of minutia the board would not want to make policy on. And then third, I was recognizing that there was an existing university-level policy that I actually wasn't aware of that was guiding naming decisions. So for those sorts of reasons, I thought it was best if this was presented as a university-level policy, in which case we could still have those changes reported to us and build in that consultation language with the assumption that we are the ultimate authority. If we ever thought we didn't like the changes, we could just take it over as a board policy.
Yeah, we wouldn't know till after the fact. So. Without ascribing a motive to any of the people who are currently involved in this process or may ultimately sit in one of the positions that's referred to here, you could have somebody who would make a decision that this policy should be rewritten. You could have a deal signed, and then the change and the fact that the deal was signed would be reported to the board. That's a result that I wouldn't be happy with. I believe that the type of transactions that we're talking about are so significant and have a long-standing material impact on the university that there has to be a larger level of control. I do agree that the board is not going to be interested in all likelihood in being involved in the minutia of the negotiation, nor have a particular interest in asking whether $5 million or $10 million is assume that we would have a great degree of deference to the suggestions made by people who are charged the responsibility of implementing this policy on a day-to-day basis. But since what the board is taking a look at now are only the most major of those transactions, I wouldn't want to find a surprise. I would want to know what was happening, because I believe the board is going to be held accountable for those decisions, whether it's on paper that way or not.
Could we build into the policy a provision that says no naming rights, no naming rights agreement will be finalized that is contrary to any of these standards without prior approval of the board?
What we're talking about, as I understand it, John, is whether or not these policies can be changed. Then if the policies are changed, you could have something done in accordance with the revised policy that we didn't know anything about.
Correct. So what I'm suggesting is if any naming rights decisions were made that were going to result in a recommendation to the board for a naming decision that relied on changes to the last iteration of the policy that we may have seen as a board, that will not happen unless the board has seen the changes that would have been required for that naming rights agreement.
I guess that would be one approach to drafting this. The other would say don't change the policy without coming back to the board. So it doesn't matter to me which way you attack the drafting challenge. I'm interested in the result.
Trustee Marshall.
Who winds up with the term final approval?
The board makes the final approval, and under the current policy, the board engages in the final approval of the naming rights recommendation that comes from the university that results from the application of these standards. We would not be the only time that the board would engage in an approval of these standards is in its first action when it adopted the changes of the regulations and by doing so also recognized the existing draft standards. Did I make things more confusing? The board ultimately approves all naming of facilities. But I think what Trustee Strauss is worried about is these naming decisions and recommendations typically involve a good deal of discussion and a dialogue with a prospective donor well before something would ever reach the board. And he's indicating that if those discussions and those agreements relied on something different than what these standards say today, that it would be very difficult for the board to say no after all of that work had been done based on the change that might have taken place in the standards without us even knowing about it.
Yeah, can I just clarify that? So it is true that the reason that I've been pushing for us to do something in this area is that I don't want the board to be put in a position where there's been extensive negotiation with a donor that we should be grateful for having interest. And there's a fully formed idea that comes to the board that we didn't know anything about, and then we're put in the position of either saying yes or no, take your money someplace else. That's not the position that the board wants to be in. I think the board wants to be in the position of saying, these are the criteria. Go have fruitful conversations with people that we are grateful to have participate with the university. And when you're finished, come back and we'll bless it because it fits with the guidelines. I believe that's the appropriate approach. It should be fully informed, consistently applied, and transparent. And the only way we get there is if those regulations are in place, they're reliable, and the board has confidence then that when something comes back to it, we can confidently vote in favor of it.
I agree with you. A few times we agree on.
Of course, the challenge would be is that no deal will fit directly in the box, right? There will be a nuance or two, right, that someone will want to negotiate. So how does that then play into this discussion we're having?
Well, I think what would happen is if you are in a conversation with a prospective donor, the foundation is, and it's attempting to abide by this policy, but it finds that it's got a deal that it likes, but it violates the policy.
Yep.
Then they would have to go to the board, change the policy, and then they would have to go back to the donor and say, okay, well, we were able to change the policy. Now we can propose your offer.
Which would be pretty tough to, as you carry that out, right? It'd be hard for the board. It'd be hard for the donor. It'd be hard for the person in the middle, for sure.
But it's a process, I believe, Tim.
Yeah, so, it's not a quick,
So I don't think this is a situation where it's going to happen and it has to be decided instantaneously it violates the policy. At least there'd be a consultative process. What I find the most disturbing possibility, not that it's happened so far, is that you'll get all the way through the process and there'll be, in effect, an expectation that the university has made a commitment before the board is even consulted about
it.
And that's precisely the situation that I want to avoid.
How do you compare and say the $100 million is fine, but A, B, C, and C need to be changed?
Well, I think that conversation happens regularly with gifts of that amount. It's a matter of when the board gets involved and is advised that those conversations.
The approval can be made as well with making exceptions to the policy, right?
Sure.
So rather than change the policy, come back and
But
as long I absolutely agree with you. We would all be stunned, right, if we agreed to do something in principle that we had that was a surprise to us. So we don't want to get in that position. So the idea that we ultimately approve is the critical thing, and we give a kind of a clear framework for negotiations. And then if it's outside of that, irrespective, it comes back here for final approval. Yeah.
I guess I get back to this larger governance. I don't have a problem, and Alan knows because we had this discussion, whether this is a board-level policy or a university-level policy, I don't care about that. I'm willing to support whatever the board wants. There's aspects of this policy that I find to be just slightly outside of the normal kinds of discussions boards should have, like how much money do you need to donate before we give you the naming rights? And there's something about it that's a little bit unseemly to me for the board to be promulgating specific dollar amounts and percentages, that it would make more sense to me if that sort of decision was at the university level, more flexible, more fluid. Maybe it could be accomplished through some kind of a schedule that we understand exists at the foundation level. I don't know. That was my concern. I was just a little bit concerned that some of the members of the board might find this somewhat so in the weeds and so materialistic, for lack of a better term, that they might not want this to be a board policy. I applaud the specificity and the thinking and the best practices that produced this document. I just worry that this may not be the kind of business the board wants to get into from a policy standpoint. And I think here I'm talking specifically about the dollar amounts and percentages.
I'm not offended. I think it's our responsibility. So, and it's not something I would feel comfortable fully abdicating and being surprised.
Was joined if the board didn't agree with what was agreed to between the foundation and the donor. Hey, this is too low. Now, I'd rather have that conversation happen beforehand between the foundation and the board. I think that would be a much easier solution to it.
This is not a hill I'm going to die on. I'm very I'm very open
I'm glad.
Whatever the, I'm very open to whatever the committee and the board wishes to do. There was just something that was what caused us, I think, to introduce this as a university level policy.
Is there any reason why you think that there would be a problem? We make this specifically, that you talk about the dollar number now. That the board and the foundation needs to bring forward to the dollar.
It gives some leverage, I think. If you're out negotiating with somebody and you have guidelines, it gives you, as a development officer, some leverage to say, you need to cross this line to get your name on the building if you're going to donate it. So it gives you some leverage, I think.
But is there any reason why, from a process standpoint, that sort of prior discussion and approval with the board before saying yes to something with a donor? Like, under this policy, there's a certain degree of yes that development and the provost, the vice president of administration and finance, they can say yes to certain things, fairly confident that it at least conforms to the policy. Mm-hmm. But I don't think this would necessarily not. I don't think this policy would preclude that.
I think the important thing to me is the fact that whatever is agreed on the dollar amount, that there should be a prior conversation, understanding between the foundation and the board. Just so that it takes the uncertainty out of it.
Yeah. So this tries to take uncertainty out by putting dollar levels in, I think, that we have to get to for somebody.
It's hard to judge what is lower level and higher level, because if you talk about $10,000 for a piece of apple or versus $100 million for a building, I mean,
it says 50% of the construction cost.
Exactly.
51%
of the construction cost.
So it's a pretty high level. So I would see if there was ever, I understand what Mark's saying here. You don't want some monkeying around to jigger it to get you to a different level without the board knowing. I guess I can't understand where that would happen. If let's say we need $100 million and somebody says, look, I can give you $40 million, it's not the 51% you need. That's such a big deal. I can't imagine that we wouldn't come talk with the board about, hey, we got $40 million. We think we can raise a certain amount above it. Can we talk about an exception or something to get that money?
That's good.
Rather than going and secretly changing the policy and then informing the board that we changed the policy, you get $40 million. I can't imagine that happening, but I understand Mark's concern that somebody could go monkey with it. But in practicality, I can't imagine anybody doing that.
John, what we're talking about is a matter of judgment. And as you know, some of us have good judgment and some of us have questionable judgment sometimes.
Right.
And you don't want to leave that cloudiness in there.
Right. So, I don't know, I'm just trying to think, is there some way to get to that point, to get some assurance to the board?
Well, I guess what I'm looking for then, I think my question goes to Jerry. So, would you find it to be unusual approve a university level policy and then subsequently wish to approve prior to any changes those changes to that policy? Well, it's still not called a board policy.
Okay. The language that's being used is misleading. One, board authority related to policy has been delegated to the president for all operational type issues. So if you defined what the university would be doing as operational, then you are absolutely correct. Coming back to the board for approval after that delegation has been done would not be appropriate. It certainly would be within the authority of the board because they're the delegating authority to do that, but it would be unusual to do that. What has been discussed as I see this are more operational than they are board policy related things. And so, and the very fact I did not draft this. My office was not involved in the drafting. We reviewed. This was done with outside, with Foundation Council. But they appropriately had this as a guideline, not as a bylaw or regulation, for that very reason, so that you would have much more flexibility in sort of going forward. I think that you can meet what I see both goals. One is no surprise by the board, and yet having the flexibility to move forward, because as an example, if you change your amendments, given your bylaws, given your current bylaw requirements, you gotta have one meeting notice beforehand, et cetera. You cannot do that in this industry. You've gotta be able to be flexible and move pretty quickly. So bottom line is, yes, this would be somewhat rare, primarily because it's more operational, in my opinion, and that's how I'm looking at this, than it is policy.
Do you have a suggestion for what we ought to do with the wording based on that?
Well, let me ask Trustee Strauss. Are you suggesting that this become a
This is a semantic game. Call it whatever you call it, a zebra. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter to me. If it changes, I want the change to be pre-approved by this board. Okay. Implementation of the policy, I'm perfectly happy to delegate. And so I don't care what we call it. This isn't a bylaw. This is a regulation. Mm-hmm. And if that policy had to come back for approval, it wouldn't even change the regulation. It would change a document referred to in the regulation. So it shouldn't be a big production, and I doubt that the policy is going to be changed. I suspect that what will happen is that somebody's going to come back and say, we have an exception to the policy. Will you approve it nonetheless? In which case, I think we'd be happy to listen to that, and if we needed to do it, we would do it. I think we're making something incredibly more complicated than it needs to be.
Just a possibility under guidelines for the board policy under 1B, we can put something in there that certainly says any changes to the policy would have to come back to the board before they would be enacted. In the policy, we can also put a paragraph in that says any exceptions to this policy would have to go to the board for approval before any something in there that also, because it doesn't allow for anything that doesn't fit in the policy, so we probably need a clause in there that says any exceptions would have to be approved by the board.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable.
And then we would cover it both ways.
Okay. We get the sting out of it. Absolutely.
All right. I'm comfortable with that. So I think if I look at the body language of the committee members, they are as well. So are there other questions and concerns about the policy? Because Alan and Catherine are going to work on a rewrite. Do we want to postpone those questions and concerns until we see this again?
Do we need to see it again, or can we just ask for changes consistent with our conversation to be
made for more review?
I don't want to hold this up for months.
Okay.
If
I thought you think that the right thing to do with that. I trust them, you know, once we have an agreement, understanding.
Once we get the document final, I suspect there will be input from the foundation. We will certainly staff it with the board so that you can see what the final document looks like.
Can I make then a few quick suggestions? I'm not sure that we need to define auxiliary facilities because it doesn't seem to be a term that comes up later in the document. And the distinction between auxiliary and Newhall is an auxiliary facility, but it doesn't seem to me to be the fact that it's an auxiliary facility doesn't seem to matter.
And I worry about the definition being financed through public-private partnerships, because that has a very specific meaning, I think, to the board that would not include, say, the students. Even though I understand why the definition is written the way it is. So I just would take it out. I just have a question about maintenance. Would this maintenance endowment be required at the time of the donation at one time, or is this an annual maintenance?
It would be a one time.
One time, okay.
But when you give five, there would be, it's kind of like when you go to an auction. You know, you buy, you bid for an item, you buy it $100, but you pay $110 because that's the fee that goes along with the, to pay the auctioneer. So this is, at the time of the donation, this would be expected as well. It would be upfront one time.
Okay. The advisory committee, thank you for working on this. I think it's important that there be a shared governance component to this. I would only ask that you widen the groups to include staff, because faculty generally means faculty, and students generally means students. So staff, and maybe add and other such stakeholders deemed relevant to the specific proposal. So you could include members of the alumni, you could include retired faculty, depending on what you're interested in.
Okay, good. Those were the only things that
Yes, just a point of clarification. You made, there was reference made to 2A2 under procedures, where there is a listing, and the question was clarify whether you need three people to vote or a majority, et cetera.
Or one, because it conflicts with 1C.
Right.
So I think you're looking for uniformity between 1C and 2C.
Yes.
Where
are you? I'm addressing 2A2
and 1C.
And 1C.
Right.
And I was addressing them in backward order. When you have three individuals, but you don't say it has to be majority, it's got to be all, et cetera. And I'm saying typically in circumstances where, you know, you're going to do majority or you designate a chair, and that chair, in consultation with, can have that determination. However you want to do it, I think clarifies it. If you do that, then I would say you use the same language in C.
Sure, we would.
Okay, and so the recommendation, this is an action item, yes. The recommendation is then to forward to the full board the proposed regulation change and policy as will be altered and amended as a consequence of this discussion.
I make a motion to do that.
Okay, second. There's a second. Any discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, that motion is carried. We have an item that I'm somewhat unfamiliar with, so I would simply ask Mr. Blakemore to explain to us what this item is and what you would like from us related to it.
Actually, I have no clue what this item is. I'm kidding. Actually, Vice President Phillips, this is actually 7B is Finance and Administration and not the General Counsel's Office.
Yeah. Which, let me see where we're looking here.
I did ask that same question, though, when I saw the agenda.
I think it's me. Oh, no. I was a little confused because it's not mine either.
Yeah. It's actually mine.
I'm glad it's somebody.
Did I miss something? Did I not get the memo?
I'm being very quiet. Oh, yeah, it's my turn. Sorry.
Dr. Long, would you?
I would be happy to lead us through this very quickly. The University Council faculty representation includes 32 people, one from each of the degree granting colleges as well as the library. The remaining seats are apportioned based on a relative ratio of faculty within a particular college to the overall number of faculty on campus. The reapportionment process is done once every 3 years. And according to the language we currently have in place, we use data from January. Well, the process of elections starts in November and runs through early February, which means that ultimately we're basing our reapportionment figures on data that are from the previous January. So the suggestion is that we, when we're doing this, make the gather the data from September so that we'll be using more current data. So it's nothing beyond that. It's just a change of do we get our data from January or September, and September gives us more current data to work with. And that went to a constitutional referendum for the faculty, and it was supported.
Okay.
So the issue is whether or not our board will concur, because that's required in the case of a constitutional
amendment. Yes. So we would ask that you please let us use better data, more current data.
I make a motion to approve the proposed revision to Article 2 of the NIU Constitution.
All right, we're motioning to forward to the full board this item. There's a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, this has passed. Thank you, Dr. Long.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking
and
of which,
this is exactly why.
Is there anything else you'd like? Not that quick.
Yeah, well, moving toward.
Let me just point out before we move into item 7C that we're going to pull together 7C and 8A as part of a single presentation where Mr. Blakemore and Dr. Long will be speaking to us. So, Mr. Blakemore, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I will make this quick, particularly given sort of our time constraints here. We start, we have obviously been involved in this process for a while. What we wanted to do at this meeting is basically two things. One, come to concurrence on how we move forward substantively, and that is really based in large part on what our ultimate goals are. And therefore, we have, as the first slide, presentation of the specific goals of constitutional reform. The action that this committee just took in terms of having to have a constitutional referendum done by the faculty and having it approved so that we could use better data is probably the best example that one could think of as to why it is not a good system to have a constitution that requires that type of action on the part of the faculty, on the part of the university, and ultimately on the part of the board. It is wasteful in terms of time, and it does not contribute, in my opinion, at all to the ultimate mission. Having said that, we are very much committed to, one, what needs to happen in terms of shared governance, two, being clear on what governing documents should be in place. Let's go to the next slide. One of the very specific things that we wanted to do, and I'm sorry, go back to number two. I'm sorry. One of the specific goals is to have what the provost and Dr. Long have referred to in discussions as a policy library, what I have actually referred to as a policy on policy. So this is not just about a constitution and governing documents. It's also about how we manage policies at the various levels of the university, particularly making certain that they are up to date, that there is a clear system to maintain them, to distribute them, and to change them, that we are transparent in that. One of the legal issues that often comes up is if we have documents
on the web that are inconsistent with documents that we might have in a corner someplace, and that kind of thing happens, which governs? So we need to have some clarity with respect to that. So constitutional reform is much broader than any specific document. By way of background, if we can go to the next, I'm going to turn this over to Greg. He'll cover the next two. I don't want to steal any of his thunder, but the most important document slide here is the next one, which really goes into what the governing documents are. But Greg?
Thank you, Jerry. And this committee has already heard this story primarily in that the Constitution for the university was a document that was created before the Board of Trustees came into existence. And through history then, when the Board of Trustees came into existence, it adopted the Constitution pretty much wholesale, but added the caveat that it is subject to the limitations of the other board governance documents. And at the same time in 1996, the board established its bylaws and its regulations. Over time, it's also created its own policies. The university also has its policies. This is the distinction that Chair Butler was talking about, university policy versus board policy. So if we could go to the next slide. This is the current hierarchy for our governance documents, and we've highlighted where the Constitution fits into that. It's smack dab in the middle. And traditionally, a constitution is an ultimate authority for an institution. Here it is not. And over time, because of the unique historical perspective, the Constitution blends policy statements, which are more appropriate for board policy, and procedural matters, which are more appropriate for university policy. And you can see then, so obviously the first item is state law, but then you have the bylaws, the regulations, the policies of the board, the Constitution, and its associated bylaws, and then the APPM. And in order to really get the full story on a substantive issue, you got to read all of these to make sure you're not missing something, which is extremely inefficient for the purposes of the institution. So if we could go to the next slide.
We have completed a review of obviously those various different documents. We've been assisted with Dr. Long, as well as the provost and president. They may have comments with respect to this during this presentation as well, of course. But here's where the bottom line for us is. After the review of these various documents, we really believe that we should reduce the number of documents that are in that category of governing documents. We specifically believe that there are certain areas of the NIU Constitution that should no longer exist in any constitution. We deal specifically with issues like grievance, and the provost has initiated a review of our grievance procedures, which a number of members from around the table are very much involved with. But the bottom line for us is the 11 separate articles, the 22 bylaws, and all of the regulations associated with it should really be dispersed to other entities, other documents, if they continue to exist at all. And if we can do that, we'll eliminate the multiple governance documents, which are at best confusing and contradictory, not to mention all of the issues that we've already talked about. If we can go to the next slide. We believe, and this is the Office of General Counsel, and we have obviously in conjunction with the President and the Cabinet, looked at what are the areas that are really pretty much within the exclusive purview of the Board of Trustees. When I say exclusive purview, that is not to suggest that there's any diminishment in terms of the board and the university's commitment to shared governance, that we look as we develop policy at whatever level to be inclusive in nature, and we're not looking when we look at having provisions, whether it's in board or other documents, to diminish in any shape, form, or fashion the rights that employees and others already have. But there are a number of areas that are very specific that we do believe are within the purview of the board, consistent with shared governance, that needs to be in the board's bylaws and regulations, not in a constitution or in other documents. We list what those are. these are the documents which we believe should be the priority for substantive review, discussion, and recommendations from the university to this committee. We will do that consistent with your directions in terms of timing. And in fact, in our next step slide, we indicate that we would be prepared to go forward with the in these areas at your next ad hoc committee meeting. Briefly, the rules and regulations relating to appointments of deans and vice presidents should be consolidated in one governance document of the board. We also believe that the rules and regulations relating to the selection and the evaluation of the president should be consolidated into and placed into one governance document of the board. Policy statements regarding human rights and academic freedom, those are currently within the purview of the board. We believe that that should continue to be so. We, however, believe that there should be some consideration to issues as to whether the human rights issues should be at a university level, since they do have some operational. So we will have that discussion. We are currently, as you know, and the board has been fully briefed on what we're looking at in terms of the freedom of expression policy. We see that, obviously, as at a university level, but it is one of significance, obviously, to the board as well. And we believe that all of the procedures related to grievance should be no place anywhere near the Board of Trustees, and that there should be serious limitations even on appeals that go to the board. And as is the practice across the country, those appeals are usually limited to violations of process, and they may relate to violations where there may be conflicts of interest, et cetera. But we need to be clear about that, and those are what we would sort of go forward with. So this lists the issues that the next steps that we would propose to the committee. We'd be prepared to go forward. Before Dr. Long speaks, there has been a great deal of discussion regarding, and it's focused on the Constitution, but it's really much broader than that. There may be individuals who may want to speak specifically to what the consensus going forward is, and so I will turn it over to Dr. Long for that and others as they wish.
So you. All right, thanks.
Greg, given the time limitation and the president having to speak at the event, perhaps you could offer him the opportunity to comment.
Well, I would just say I appreciate taking this on. It's, I think Greg's made a great case that it's a mess and that it needs to be corrected, and I appreciate he and Jerry working together on putting together kind of the priorities to go through this and how to really clean it up, and we're looking to make it work more efficiently and effectively while having the appropriate processes in place to protect people's rights. So I think we're directionally correct here, and we just got to work through the complex issues to make it happen. Really appreciate their work, and I do have to go make some presentation, so I will excuse myself.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Let me just simply put in the record that we are in receipt of a memorandum from Dr. Long, May 14, 2016. We should have received this last evening, which summarizes some of the observations you may be drawing from in your remarks.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity to have this chance to talk a little bit more about this. I recognize this is a collaborative process that will absolutely involve Office of General Counsel and the Board of Trustees, Provost's Office, that this is a project that will require a lot of inclusion and collaboration to move forward. As I've talked to you previously, we really looked at this as initially kind of a three-prong kind of an issue that as has been mentioned, the bylaws contain far too much specificity. The structure of the documents don't necessarily make a lot of sense. As a faculty member, typically a faculty senate would be making curricular decisions, and our faculty senate is largely a caucus body. But the one thing that has been the biggest roadblock for us, at least historically, was Article 22 in the bylaws, because that was the article that dealt with the threshold to change a bylaw. And since we had everything, you know, specified as bylaws, and then we have this criteria that said you had to have two-thirds of the entire membership present two-thirds to endorse it. And so that's 40 out of 60, roughly, and we were having 44, 45 people show up. So any vote, you're starting off with 15 no's. That was problematic. On March the 2nd, we were very, very pleased, and it actually resulted in a round of applause in the group. So I think the group was also happy about this. We changed the voting threshold to where we have a attendance requirement of 60% plus one, and then it's basically two-thirds of people in attendance so long as we hit at least a majority of the overall membership. So, again, that was received very well, and in fact, this most recently, we had another vote that was one that last year, it was on the Baccalaureate Curriculum Council, and it was a vote that last year had a vote of 38-2-1, if I'm not mistaken, something roughly that. And, you know, it was one thing, it's like you have 95% people endorsing it, but since we didn't meet the criterion, it didn't pass. So that then came back, for this, during this month's meeting, and passed with ease. And so I mention this because changing the voting threshold has now given us the opportunity to look at things with a bit more confidence as moving forward, because in the past, we were kind of subject to the tyranny of the few, if you would, and now I think we have a much more democratic, much more inclusive process. So that was a very big thing that happened on March 2nd. That it kept me up nights worrying. So I was quite pleased that worked. Shortly after that meeting happened, I called a group of basically advisors together, representing the different constituencies, as indicated in my report here. I do not personally have the knowledge and ability to do this by myself in any way, shape, or form. So reaching out to others, developing a committee of people to help organize this, in addition to what the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee would do just as part of their role within University Council. And as you'll note in the report, our first task, and this is one I'd shared with you before, is basically looking at the documents that we currently have and seeing, are there problems? And if you'll take a quick look at page 2, rather than give you a list of 50 unique problems, I thought it would be easiest to convey this by saying, let's look at this thematically. Because as you look through the documents, and I will acknowledge certainly support from the General Counsel's office, the Provost's office in identifying these areas, but if you take a quick look, redundant information, we have things that are, in multiple places that, again, make it difficult to understand. Wording varies. Is 10 days the same as 14? I'm sure that when it was put out there, 14 was meant as 10 working days across 2 weeks. That's 14 days. But yet, in the document, it's not clear, so it creates a potential for confusion. Outdated and incorrect information. We've got titles that are incorrect throughout many of our documents. We've got job classifications that are no longer in existence. Sometimes there's even places where we ask for Social Security numbers. And again, that should not be the case. That should not be in any of our documents. Identified incomplete information, and this is, pretty much throughout. Lots of information about ideas, but the specifics of how one would play that out are not clear. I mean, one example I have here, and it's a concern as a faculty member, is financial exigency. What happens with regard to programs? And yet, if you look specifically at the details of that, it's not necessarily clear. And so hopefully that's never going to be a problem for us. But from the standpoint of clarity, I see that as a concern. Obviously, the number 5 structural issues we've talked about would certainly emphasize what Jerry said related to the grievance focus. Our grievance processes are in need of some significant revision and review. There are oftentimes multiple pathways that people can grieve. There's not necessarily any sort of screening to make sure that a grievance is tracked in a particular or most appropriate fashion. So would certainly argue from our standpoint, grievances are something that need to be looked at. But as the other part of the structural issue, though, is, and I think it's the one that certainly from my perspective and as we've talked with the General Counsel's office, that idea of where can we have policies in a place that people can look at? Where do we know what to look at? A policy repository, a policy of policies, whatever we might want to call it, that seems to be a really important step to take. And it's not to change policy. The idea here is not to go in and make revision in terms of major content. but to basically clean things up and put things where they should belong so that, you know, if you need to look for a policy, you would know where to look. And if there are disagreements or conflicts in the process, we can have a discussion on how those get resolved. So, as I mentioned, I just gave you a few examples. I thought presenting it thematically might be a little more helpful than just a long list of, see page 22, article 2. But if you want any more detail, I can certainly provide that. I think we're making a fairly strong argument that the documents are problematic. I mean, hopefully I've established that. The other thing, as far as a next step, immediate step, Mike Sweeney, who's the GA for our office, and I are, we've downloaded a lot of constitution and bylaws from different universities across the country, the MAC schools, selected schools, and the IPEDS data, you know, to say, how do these universities structure their constitution and bylaws? And we're in the process of doing that. I can tell you right now, and again, supporting what Jerry said earlier, the number of articles and that we have in the constitution and bylaws significantly exceed what you see in any other documents that I've reviewed thus far. That's not to say that there might not be ones that are more confusing than ours, but if we're talking about top 10, I think ours is a pretty confusing document with far too much specificity. So we're going to basically creating a template to say, all right, if you looked at these 20 programs or these 20 universities out there, what are the common constitutional articles or the common bylaw articles? So let's at least look at that. And that's a task that we're working on right now and hope to have finished and available for you all for review within a month's time. So again, further discussion is just a follow-up. Where do the policies live? You know, who owns them? How do we make sure that changes are appropriate but provide the protections that are already in place? Because right now there are a number of issues that it's unclear who takes responsibility for what and who owns it and how do you make changes with it. And, you know, from a moving forward standpoint, clarification on that I think would be very helpful. From our standpoint, and I'm very invested in being sure that this is a shared governance kind of a endeavor, so that already recruited the presidents of the Operating Staff Council, the SPS Council, going to ask the Student Association. We've got the chair of the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee, the vice president of the Faculty Senate, to work together over the summer and look through the materials we're collecting and try to come up with some type of outline by the end of summer that would say at least, here's potentially what a revised constitution bylaw might look like, and here's the idea of where policies might be better located. Because the thought would be that if the group I just described, we're the leaders of the constituencies out there. So, any individual constituency might have an issue, but if their president is part of the discussion, I think that makes it a little bit easier. And also by creating something for people to look at, that's a far easier thing to edit and discuss than trying to, say, have a constitutional convention and start from scratch. So we'd like the opportunity to, create a template, pull together some ideas, and keep you informed and, get your feedback throughout the process.
Okay. Trustee Strauss.
We've already noted that there are inconsistencies and large operational problems that come from having some of the documents that are currently in effect. So I think you've already gotten preliminary feedback from this committee that we're interested in participating in the process. The threshold question that I have for you is whether UAC has endorsed this process now or whether this is a leadership initiative that hasn't yet gotten full support from all the constituencies on campus.
We've had significant discussion on this topic in Faculty Senate and in University Council, and I've certainly talked to my other presidents of the councils and the faculty members of UAC, and I get there's no resistance anywhere. I think anyone who has had any experience with these really would like to see the change. I mean, it's encouraging from that standpoint of I'm not finding anyone who says leave it as is.
Well, I applaud the willingness of all of the other constituencies on campus to participate in this effort. And then I think the question for this committee becomes, how do we participate in this? I believe that there are some things that the board may have an interest in seeing
Absolutely.
Get expressed in a different way. And I'm not sure that we would have the ability to be able to participate with the same rapidity that you have been able to achieve with the other constituencies on campus. And so I think my first feeling on this is that maybe this committee should delegate to staff the ability to be able to represent our interests in these initial conversations that are going on. And then at some point, I would want to hear what the progress was with regard to this. But again, I'd be interested in hearing what the other committee members have to say on the subject.
Simplify for me, period.
Absolutely.
Pardon me?
Simplify for me. Make it simple.
Yes, that is our goal. Simple is better. Because right now, I mean, even if I'm talking as a professor right now, but if you look at our documents, for example, in the Academic Policies and Procedure Manual, that's where the grade appeal policy is. I use that as a demonstration when I talk in class, because if you look at that policy, it averages 40 words per sentence and is written at the 21st grade level. Now, from a communication standpoint, that I would spank a student. You know, I'm sorry, figuratively. But yeah, I would not let that happen if I was, you know, if I was writing it or having a student write it. And yet, from our standpoint as a document, that's what we've got. So I think that kind of language and that level of complexity is just throughout.
Just for the record, Dr. Long is not my client.
Repeat my statement.
Oops.
I would disown him.
Yeah. Him, right. Okay, so I'm trying really hard here. Yeah.
So are we looking for action on this?
No. Right. Well, we have the prerogative for action in this category. If you want to make a motion that we formally delegate to the staff the authority to continue to negotiate on behalf of the committee, its changes and alterations that ultimately to recommend to the committee, then we could do that here.
Might I suggest that you add to that the delegate establishes a tight communication with this committee?
Yes, I'll make that motion. I'll make that motion.
Could you repeat that motion?
Yes. The motion is that this committee delegates responsibility to staff to participate in the ongoing negotiations regarding the reformation of the organic university governing documents, and that our delegates for this purpose remain in close consultation and communication with this committee.
Second.
The motion's been made and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none. Excellent. So,
thank you for the support.
Thank you, Dr. Long. We appreciate your continued work in this area. It's very important to us. I think we're becoming more specific as to what we're concerned with. And I would again invite the committee to consult the document that we approved as our work plan when we first were created, and indicate under C the 16th item, which is constitutional review and recommendation, which is what we just talked about. So we are well on track in managing our mission. On that point, the next item for our discussion I want to make very brief. I simply want to indicate to you if we had more time, what I would like us to talk about, but I think in the interest of time, we'll just take the documents that I shared with you and we'll put this off for a subsequent meeting. But let me first tell you what those documents are and why you have them. So you were provided two documents to support a board discussion on this this item. My agenda's missing for some reason.
Sure.
The item is titled Review Standing Committee and Ad Hoc Structure and Charters. One of the work plans of this committee was to reform all standing committee charters and charges
to include purposes, powers, duties, and the establishment of committee benchmarks and other measures, as indicated for the Carl Committee. So you have been given a copy of the excerpts from the entire Article 6 of the Board bylaws, which include descriptions of the purpose, membership, and meetings and power and duties provisions for the Executive Committee, the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee, a much more expansive Section 3 dealing with what we call the Carl Committee, and subsequently the other standing committees of the Board, the Legislative Affairs, Research and Innovation Committee, Finance, Facilities and Operations, and then a description of ad hoc committees. The original objective of that goal was to look at the description of the purpose and role of the Carl Committee and take that as a kind of best practices. So where we took the time in our bylaws to articulate in a much more expansive way what the purpose of the committee was, what are the relevant offices and divisions that report to the committee, what are the expectations that the board has for those units, and what I would like us to do is to develop the same level of specificity for each of the other committees in Article 6. And so what I wanted to do was simply point out that I hope that we can begin to work on that and to say to Mr. Blakemore that we're open to that. And in addition to that, I offered you a copy of the memorandum that I authored in September of 2014 that created the two ad hoc committee meetings that met today. And the purpose of that is because as part of this process of looking at the standing committees, I think we should be mindful of the fact that these ad hoc committees have existed now for quite some time. Ad hoc committees are supposed to be temporary. And there is a point at which we should be talking about whether we wish to make the ad hoc committees permanent or fold the duties of the ad hoc committees more formally into the other standing committees as we are writing the more expansive charges. So I offer you this this documentation for your review and consideration so that we can prepare ourselves for this this next effort of ours. And let me ask if anyone wishes to say anything on that. Trustee Strauss.
I'd like to make a recommendation that, because I know action isn't appropriate at this point in time, but I'd like to make a recommendation that this work be commenced and that it include a couple of things. The transformation of the ad hoc committees into standing committees, and that as part of this process we also find a home at the board level for local government relations, which is not currently assigned to any committee.
Does anyone have anything to say in regard to that recommendation? It's not an action item. We're just simply talking.
Oh, Mark, you're talking about three additional committees?
Two, Bob. We have two ad hoc committees currently.
Right. The third one was what you mentioned. Was
I believe that the local government relations can be folded into one of the existing committees. I think that right now, by default, it's not making any reports, but our intention was that it would fall to the Finance, Facilities, and Operations Committee. Practically, where there have been issues locally, they involve the commitment of resources, and that's where the issues have come up. But that was by default. That wasn't through any intent.
How many committees do we have now without those two additional ones?
We have four.
Four, six.
Correct.
Not counting the Executive Committee.
That's correct.
Yeah. So this would be, and this gets into another subject which we were to take up in the context of an evaluation of the board performance, which was whether we wanted to produce any kind of guidelines or expectations for trustee service, and in the area of committee service, whether we wanted to, as a board, perhaps clarify that the expectation would be that only a certain number of board members would serve on a certain number of standing committees.
I was counting the number of board members we have versus the number of, that's why I asked that question.
So we could, going forward, add two more standing committees, but also we could either informally through guidelines or recommendations or formally through an amendment to our bylaws and limit the number of committees that board members can be a member of, just to kind of divide up some of the duties. In the past, frankly, we've just had a custom of putting all the board members on all the standing committees. We don't need to do that. This could also lead us to altering the meeting dates of the committees. We could adopt a guideline that says at no such time shall more than four standing committees meet on one day, and that would require that at least two meet on some other day.
John, I think that when you mentioned all members on all committees, that just took place this year?
No, it's been going on for quite some time. Not forever, but pretty much since I've been on the board, all board members have been on all the committees. Now, there have been times where there's been alterations attempted, and then board members wanted to be there. One of the issues is that with all the committee meetings on the same day, it just made sense let everybody be on all the committees. They're there anyway. But we could rethink the structure of the whole committee process, how many trustees are on each committee, and what are the expectations of service. But I think it starts with determining what committees do we need, how do we describe them, and then I think we can think, do we want to place limitations on the amount of service trustees give to those committees?
Yeah, go ahead.
There's an alternative. If people are interested in continuing service on virtually all the committees, and that's to just meet as a committee of the whole, to be able to hear all of the topics at once in a combined committee meeting. And that's not my preference. I think we would do best to have a proposal developed along the lines that I recommended previously, and then if it turns out that after discussion there are other things that people want to do, we could disassemble that work and reassemble it in another way, or it'd be impossible to do this in the other way. At least we'll have something in front of us that we can act on instead of having three or four meetings to get to a point where there's something that's actionable.
I would suggest that. Go ahead.
I would support that thinking. The real question at hand, but obviously we need to continue our work on enrollment and governance. So the work has to continue, and I appreciate the idea that ad hoc should live or die at some point in time, so we clearly have to live. Then it's the question, do you fold them in? Doesn't seem like there's a real natural place for those to fold in, and they're also so important, especially enrollment today, that seems like we'd be doing that a disservice by tucking it in. I also agree then if when you look at it and say, boy, you have six committees, that's too much you're going to do a lot of work, but not very well, all of us, right? It's clear to me that each of us have different talents and interests, and that you'll get more passion and vigor around that and probably better work by dividing and conquering, provided we're a seasoned and mature board and respect and appreciate the work that each other does, which in my short tenure, I think what I'm sensing, surely there is. So I'd very much support the idea and what you're proposing, Mark.
I'd like to suggest that rather than trying to make some decisions in this format, that propose some details for the full board to, in private session, to discuss it, so that it makes sense when we hear all the opinions on it, rather than shotgunning it. Think through it with the details, and then we can all talk about it.
That's basically what I suggested. Give us the details, but give us the details of a proposal that has an committees and a home for local government relations.
And the time frame of how to do it all, you know.
Yeah, and we won't move this quickly. I mean this is not my intention. This is a big deal. It's going to take some time to write the more expansive charters for the existing standing committees. We've got a start on the ad hoc committees because of the memorandum, but it's just a start. And we may even decide to move some aspects of the other standing committees into governance. There's a number of different things that we might do that we're not even sure of at this point. So I think Trustee Strauss' recommendation is well taken, that we should commence this process. And Trustee Boy, I give you my guarantee I will not try to move this fast. And I'll make certain that all of the trustees have ample time to consider any new structure that we're presenting.
I think that, like you said, have a thorough review of the existing committees and see how it can play out. Do we need some, or do we need them all, or whatever cases, and combine them?
Yeah, it may be that we end up with five, and maybe we end up, dare I say, more. I don't think we will. But I think we're ready. We've got a recommendation. Anybody else wish to address the matter of committee structure and descriptions? Okay. Again, I don't have...
Sure.
For some reason, it's gone. Maybe Dr. Baker took my... So we know what the next steps are, I think. And are there other matters to come before the committee? The next meeting date will be determined. Before we adjourn, I'll just point out, again, we have a special meeting of the board that I suspect Trustee Strauss will be convening in 5 minutes from the adjournment of this meeting. And so is there a motion to adjourn?
Move.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Meeting's adjourned.